This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
New Books Network and your host, Nathan Moore, welcome Barbara Kinnear to an episode on history. She co-authored today's book with Colonel Richard Ernest Evans. The title? Richard Eager, a pilot's story from Tennessee Eagle Scout to General Montgomery's Flying Fortress. Colonel Richard Ernest Evans was a heroic pilot that went from the Tennessee Eagle Scouts to General Montgomery's Flying Fortress. His family has released a biography that we're discussing today, showcasing the humanity and personality of war heroes through detailed accounts of Golden Age aviation that span the 1930s to the 1960s. His daughter and author, Barbara Kinnear, hopes to preserve more of Richard's legacy with this book's release, and proceeds will benefit the Air Force Aid Society. And also, because this year is the Air Force's 75th anniversary, it is timely. Barbara, please give your audience more details about your family history, aviation, and also Colonel Richard Evans.
Thank you, Nathan. And again, thank you for your interest in this book. I'm very grateful for this opportunity to talk with you. This book is a large one. My father wrote it in 1990 to 1993, but just to give you a bit about my family, as you've asked, dad was born in Tennessee. He had a wonderful family. There were five boys, and one did pass away at 2 years old. His father was the principal of Knoxville High School for 41 years. He grew up, as a normal kid in Tennessee, enjoying the Smoky Mountains. As he was growing up, of course, the World War I was over, and folks thought that World War I was over forever, but it was not. As he became high school, he was extremely involved in the ROTC. He knew the war was coming, and he was beginning to realize he would be called, so he was making preparations. He became an Eagle Scout because he loved scouting, and that really had so much to do with his life, the rest of his life. He knew the war was coming, as I mentioned, so he decided he wanted to fly and not walk. So he became a pilot on his own, and then he entered the military. They called him up, and he went into the U.S. Army Air Corps. So he served during the war, and then he went into the reserves after the war, and then the Korean War came in, and they asked him back to work in the Air Force, which he did. And he continued for 20 years plus in the Air Force. He flew everything he could get his hands on. But my brother and I will say my family, We grew up in the Air Force. We were very happily called ourselves Air Force brats. And we moved around with my father and my mother, and we're very proud to be a part of the Air Force family.
And when did you both start writing this book? And also, when did you get involved with it?
My father started writing it between 1990 and 1993. He was telling his stories, and my brother encouraged him, "Dad, why don't you write these stories down?" And so he started, and this was, you know, already 50 years past, basically 50 years past the war. So he worked very hard. He focused on the facts and making sure that what he wrote and remembered were true. And he wrote with humility. He wrote with humor. And he had a great sense of history and what was very important for a reader to understand about what was going on in the war. He had a very interesting place. He was General Field Marshal Montgomery's pilot for 4 months plus. And he got to know the general quite well since they were flying around North Africa. And there would be times when the general would be up in the cockpit with my dad and sometimes getting flying lessons. So that was a very interesting part of the book, the relationship with this extremely famous general, which I can tell you about a little later. He was, of course, the head of the British Army. I think also he wrote with, I helped along the way as far as being a willing listener. And so were other family members. But he wrote, you know, he worked hard on it. And we would, so I will tell you that I had all of his chapters. He tried to get it published. He tried to, but in those days, they didn't have the ability to be an independent publisher as well. In fact, I think if you were an independent publisher, you were called a vanity publisher. But so he got older and he passed away in 2006. I vowed that I would finish the book and get it published because I thought his stories were wonderful stories, and people would want to understand what was going on in North Africa in the Mediterranean during World War II. So the heart and soul of the book would be the 21 chapters. He also wrote a glossary with humor, Yankee humor, not an academic glossary. And so it's almost another part of the book. It is, of course, part of the book. I've developed a chronology that was very important to show where he was and what was going on around him. And it was a chronology of his entire life. I had all of his Air Force archive personnel material. I do have all of his flight records. So the flight records for a pilot, of course, are extremely important because it proves how many hours you have flown and what you have flown. So I knew exactly where he was in North Africa because of those flight records and what he flew. That was very, very important in the book, I believe. Also, the book is large. It's 508 pages because there are documents of orders that are very pertinent. The order, for example, telling him that he was going to be General Montgomery's pilot. Also, 150 photographs are in the book. They're iconic and they're beautiful. Some from family, some from the Imperial War Museum, some from other places. Also, the letters back and forth to family, which were written at that point of time. So you knew exactly what he was thinking and what family members were thinking. So that's also part of history.
And who else was involved with authoring the book? Maybe not the authors themselves, but did anybody contribute to making it happen?
Yes, you extremely wonderful, skilled people have helped me with this book. Of course, Dad was the author, and it was what I didn't mention to you is that I lost all the chapters in the fire in Santa Barbara, California. the entire home was burned to the ground. And so I didn't have the chapters that I thought were his best. I thought, how am I going to do this? He died in 2006. The fire was in 2008. And soon, many months later, my stepmother said, come get all these boxes. They belong to your dad. And so I did. And in those boxes were drafts and drafts and drafts and wonderful material. Then I realized we can do this book. We can pull it together. So the helpers would be wonderful people that I knew were good readers to make sure that they could give me their thoughts on the chapters. My wonderful husband and daughter, wonderful editors. We worked very hard. We researched. I researched everything, again, all the facts. We went to London, went to the Imperial War Museum, went to the photographic archives and the other archives that held Monty's diaries, General Montgomery's diaries. Those were all very important resources. So that was part of it. So then I had a wonderful line editor who made sure that the dots connected, that, you know, you mentioned somebody in chapter 20 and they weren't mentioned before. What is the connection? That those kinds of interesting pieces of a book that you need to clean up. I had a wonderful designer, which she chose the color blue, which I love. And also, of course, it's very important that you have beautiful graphics and you have beautiful typeset. And also a publisher here in my town helped me get it online. And the book became live, as they say, on Amazon on September 12th, 2021. And now it is a hardcover, a soft cover, and now it's also a digital ebook. So many, many people have helped. Also, a publicist has been helping me get the word out. It's so important. You can put a book online, but nobody knows it's there unless they happen by. The keywords, of course, are important, but you still need help to get the word out.
Much of the book starts in Tennessee. How important is Tennessee to the overall making of your research?
Tennessee is where the family was born and brought up. It's, hometown Knoxville. That was very important because of how dad and his brothers were brought up and what gave them the resources. They all four survived the war, three pilots and one navigator, all very lovely men. Tennessee was very important because of that, because of their upbringing. And just the life in Tennessee was described, just how they grew up, what did they do, and how was the high school or the junior high and things like that. So Tennessee was very, very important. Dad did not settle in Tennessee, though, after the war. He was in the LA area in Pasadena, where he went into the insurance business. But again, the Korean War started, and the Air Force asked him to come back. So then Florida became a part of our family, Nebraska and Texas. The other parts of Dad also spent, of course, tremendous amount of time in the Mediterranean fighting World War II. So he was in all over North Africa, Sicily, Italy, Malta. And then he had to fly over Switzerland, to the German embedded countries.
You were raised in Pasadena. Was your story different from your dad's in Tennessee, or do you see a lot of similarities in Richard's upbringing for you?
I think it's very different. Dad was grew up from all his life, all of his, let's say, educational life up to high school, college. He was in college for 2 years before he was pulled into the war. Very different because he's in one place. So I grew up, and my brother and I, as moving around because the Air Force moves you around a lot. We were in Florida in Texas, excuse me, we're in California, and then Florida for 3 years while Dad worked with the B-47, magnificent airplane. Then we went to, he progressed up the line and he became a colonel, and we were at Strategic Air Command and off at Air Force and Air Force Base. Then that is near Omaha, Nebraska. And then he was transferred to Carswell Air Force Base, Fort Worth, Texas. And so we moved there as well. And that's when he was flying the B-58. He actually was the first SAC, or Strategic Air Command, officer to fly the B-58. And that was an amazing, amazing jet. Could do Mach 2, which is twice the speed of sound.
So next question then, following up with your previous question, is about some of those airplanes. The B-17 Flying Fortress and the B-29 Super Fortress, why are those so important for you? And what other airplanes did he fly again?
The B-17 was extremely important because that was the first bomber that he was in during World War II. He had tremendous training in the B-17 in the United States before he flew over. And they took the southern route. He was part of the 99th Battle Group, and they had a group of 38 B-17s, brand new, out of Boeing B-17s, and they flew from Miami down to past Cuba, down to the South America, and then they had to fly over the Atlantic, which is really frightening. There's no place to stop if you have a problem when you're flying over the Atlantic. And they landed in Africa. So the B-17 was an extremely important plane. They called it the Flying Fortress because it had 9 guns on it. There were 10 men on that plane. And the plane was very important because it could be shot up and it would still make it home. And of course, there were many crashes, many, many losses, of course, you know, hundreds of losses. But if that plane was hit a lot, it still could get home. It had a lot of backup. So the pilots appreciated that B-17 very much. The B-29 was a very fine plane, could get a lot higher in altitude. So, for example, the B-29 in fighting in the Pacific was higher in altitude, and the Japanese couldn't reach it to bring it down. So they were able to, you know, it's sad, they were able to bomb Tokyo and such from a higher altitude. So it was very, very beautiful airplane as well. Dad flew the B-47, the B-52, and the B-58, as I mentioned. He flew trainers, he flew fighters. He flew fighters for fun because he was not a fighter pilot. He was a bomber pilot. I like to say that the B-17 was produced by many, many Rosie the Riveters. They were out there constructing those planes, and they are to be applauded.
And what about Eager's 99th Bomb Group? Was he always a part of this group, or did he ever change his regiment?
He started out on the 99th, and they were making it. Flying their missions, and then he was asked. And he was getting really good at what he was doing. He was learning to be a very fine pilot. And as they flew over Italy, Sicily, small islands, to help rid those areas of the Italian and the German armies. Back to your question. When he was ordered to fly an American B-17 with an American crew, the Field Marshal, British General Montgomery, he became part of the 8th Army. All by himself, I mean, with the B-17. So wherever General Montgomery wanted to fly, that's where Daddy would fly him. So for a while there, he worked with the British 8th Army. And then when he went to the Pacific, he worked with another squadron, and that was the B-29 squadron, the 316th Bomb Wing, and that put him in Okinawa. And fortunately, very few months after, the two nuclear bombs were sent, and he was able to, the end of the war. So then he got himself home in a very interesting way, flying the other direction. A lot of people wanted to, after the war, it was very hard to get home because all the transports were full of a lot of Army people. And so he found a way of, instead of flying from Okinawa east to the United States, he found rides and flew west. So he went over the Atlantic to get home. Anyway.
Were you and the family a part of those trips abroad, or were you always in the States?
We were always in the States. After the war, that's when we came, you know, we were born. So we were always in the States. And Dad, my father's, he was stationed in the States because of the Strategic Air Command. So, but there were times when he'd be gone for quite a while. In Florida, he worked with testing the B-47, and they tested for speed, they tested for temperature, they tested for everything. And the whole idea was to show, and sadly, this was the Cold War after South Korea, after the Korean War, there's the Cold War. And so they were very, very, you know, always testing the B-47 to show the folks in Moscow, in the communist country, that our B-47 could make it over there if they had to protect, for example, part Berlin or some other countries. So they were always testing. Another dad was in charge of testing the B-47 in Greenland and Newfoundland. You know, what could they start those engines up in, you know, sub-freezing temperatures? Very interesting. What? How do you take off in those temperatures? You know, how do you keep your runway in good shape? You know, what do you wear? So he had to be gone for 3 months at a time, a couple of times when we were in Florida. In Nebraska, no. So basically, he flew and we stayed in one place.
And what kinds of sources did you have access to that maybe the public wouldn't have, especially in your research process?
So the resources were his Air Force personnel files and the Air Force flight records. That was fabulous. But the other resources were other, when looking up the background of other officers that my father worked with, also you can do that. You know, there's so much now on the internet for all of us to research. That's a big help. And then, of course, the Air Force archives that are in Washington and I think in St. Louis. The Imperial War Museum, fabulous resources, just amazing resources. And you get permission and you go and you read and you look and copy. And it's wonderful what is available. So as far as people being a lot of, you know, all of Dad's friends are gone. So there were not other people I could talk with. So basically resources in museums and archives that I used. And personal, as I said, the files that my father kept. He kept, thank goodness, wonderful files. And how they made it from war zones, you know, his orders, for example, how he made it from war zones to the United States was probably a small miracle.
Who do you think also had the most impact for you and for Richard's life in terms of maybe interviewing or in terms of also like having a legacy to, you know, share these kinds of stories outside of you?
Outside of me. For Dad, his father. His father was a wonderful, compassionate, smart man. That was my father's resources in growing up. And he and his mother also was just a very fine family. They were very, very good parents. to their children. So there, that was their resources in growing up. For me, my family are my resources also. That's so, you know, that's where you go first is family. And you mentioned interview. I never interviewed another person in regards to my dad's book as far as a resource.
You include poems in this book that he wrote. What can you tell us about those poems?
He wrote with humor, not only in the regular stories, but with his poems. And they, not that they were all funny, but he loved it. And I think it's because he had a very fine literature background growing up. And his father, for example, you mentioned, you know, that one of the poems is Invictus, called Flyboy Invictus. And Invictus was a poem by William Ernest Henley in 1875. And that was a poem that his father said, memorize this, son, memorize this poem. Because, and that shows you the importance that literature meant to his father and his mother, I think. Because, you know, for example, this poem was a poem of inner strength. And even when Dad got it, in his stories, he would see it when he got into some trouble where he was, you know, life and death, he would remember this poem because of it was inner strength. So, but he just enjoyed it. He enjoyed funny. He wrote funny letters home. I received funny letters, you know, again, that was the sense of humor that he had. And so somewhere along the line, he realized he could write. I think also, I didn't start writing this book until 1990, but the fact that he saved so many pieces of his background or his, you know, these letters and these V-mails, that makes me realize that he probably had a thought about writing it, but maybe he wasn't clear. Also, there's a letter I read from his mother that said, son, everybody loves your letters. They think you should write a book. And that was back in 1939. So he finally did, and we were so proud of him.
The Stars and Stripes is a popular newspaper. Do you know of any more journalism outlets that either Richard was consuming or that he was mentioned in stories?
None. None at all. There was so many men and women in the war having stories of their own. Yes, there would be a little news article in the Knoxville newspaper regarding something that my father had done, that you had to be very, you know, the communications from the war, the military had to be extremely careful about what they sent home. And they were, and oftentimes a letter with too much information didn't make it to the family, but there would be small articles, but nothing large at all regarding his position and what he did in the war. But I do have a little something that he sent his father regarding, you know, because he was being the pilot for General Montgomery was a big deal. Big deal. Number one, he was trusted to keep the safety of the Field Marshal Montgomery, keep him safe in an airplane. And so they trusted Dad's ability to be a pilot. They also trusted his ability to be careful, you know, to keep quiet about it. For example, if any German spy knew that Dad was flying Montgomery, and they call him Monty for short, in this airplane, the B-17 Teresa Leda, that plane would be attacked to bring the, you know, what they wanted was to get rid of General Montgomery. But this one little thing about how he felt about being the pilot, and I'll read it to you. And it was a letter, June 19th, 1943. And my father said to his father, these experiences with the brass hats are unusual, Pop, and as such, interesting. But know ye, they are not the real thing. I am these days in the company of generals, air marshals, and kings, only because of circumstances, not because of anything meritorious that I have accomplished.
Who's Mrs. Oglesby?
Oh, that's Oglesby. Mrs. Yes. Oglesby was a cranky lady down the street. But she was a sad lady. They felt like she was sad, she and her husband, because they didn't have kids. And so she had a beautiful, beautiful garden that she loved. And there's a whole chapter on her, of course, because my father was probably 6 or 7 years old, and he got talked into doing something very, very bad by his older brother. And that was what happened was Mrs. Oglesby poisoned a neighbor's dog because the dog was in her yard. And this was, of course, horrific, especially in the mind of a 7-year-old or 8-year-old. So Dad was talked into doing this. So in the middle of at night, he was talked into taking hot tar in a bucket and going up and down the sidewalk in front of her house. And so, of course, that was a horrible thing for him to do. And he was a youngster. And the whole story is how his father worked with Dad about it, that it was not a good thing to do. It was an interesting and sad story, because then also when Dad had to walk up and say he was sorry to Mrs. Oglesby, she also felt sorry that she had poisoned a dog. So it was a sad story as well as another, again, a story of learning as a child with the help of your father.
How has the Tennessee community responded to Richard's legacy? Are there dedications to him anywhere in the Knoxville community or nearby?
No, there are no dedications. Knoxville sent many, many, many young men off to war, and more men than women, of course. And there are, of course, memorials, for all of the men that went to the different wars. And then my father survived the war, so you won't see a memorial to him because he didn't die in the war. So Knoxville does not recognize him as some great person. The friends of Knoxville, the family, they remember Dad. And again, he and his brothers and many others went to war. So it wasn't something that he did by himself. He joined a lot of other very brave men and women.
Who is General Montgomery? I know that's in the title.
Yes, sir. General Montgomery is the field marshal. He is best known as chasing General Rommel, the German, very famous German general, out of North Africa. And also chasing the Italian and German armies out of Sicily and out of Italy. The whole idea was, the reason why Montgomery was down there was to defend Rommel. Let me say, to defend, of course, North Africa. But Rommel was very close to Cairo. And if he'd gotten to Cairo, he would have taken the Suez Canal. And that would have been a real difference in how the war was fought, in World War II was fought, a real difference. It could have been, it would be catastrophic if the Germans had control of the Suez Canal, because the gas, the military, whatever was needed to fight the war would have to go another route. The whole Mediterranean was very dangerous as well. So it would have been catastrophic for the British at that time. So he was a very famous general because he was extremely good with his army. For example, he would not just go ahead unless there was support, like all the everything they needed, the ammunition, the petroleum, the food, the first aid was right there with the army as they forged ahead, chasing the Germans and the Italians out of North Africa, city by city by city by village, by mountainside. So he was a very famous general. He was very persnickety. He was arrogant. A lot of the American generals Eisenhower, for example, did not like him really, but he was beloved by his army and he knew what he was doing. And he actually replaced another general in Egypt who was not doing the job. And Rommel was getting very close to the Suez Canal. He also was a great general in Normandy, you know, fought side by side, basically, or planned, let's put it, planned side by side with General Eisenhower.
And King George VI, why was he a significant part of this story too?
He was a significant part because my father got to meet him. And he was important, of course, because he was the king of the UK and the British Commonwealth. He was the father of our late Queen Elizabeth. So why was he important? He was visiting when General Montgomery was able to get the German and Italians out of North Africa. The king was able to come visit all the different military outposts to thank them and to show them how much how important it was, and extremely wonderful for morale. Excuse me. But when he came to this airport, Castel Bonito, which was in Libya, that's where my father had just come in with the B-17 to work with General Montgomery. General Montgomery was extremely proud of his American B-17. So he actually had my father put it in just the right place. So when the king was coming to meet everybody, he would see it. And so the king met my father. And there's a chapter called The King and I, or My Father Met the King. Mm. And they had a conversation. And it's funny, the conversation. And on the whole description of that day. So the king was very important to my father because, number one, they met. And that was a wonderful, as you know, how often does an army officer get to meet a king? So that was part of it.
Also, you mentioned Eisenhower. Are there any other presidents who you think you can vouch for?
No, I just know, my father wrote of Eisenhower because he was the commander of the entire World War II effort for America. But as far as other presidents being involved in our lives, not really. They were just presidents as we grew up, different presidents, which is not a very good answer. But no, it's Eisenhower, of course, was amazing, leader in World War II. And so that's why he's in the book a lot.
You write about the family dog. And then also Richard's nickname is Dick, apparently.
Well, he was called Dick as a kid. And then the Richard Eager, though, which is, of course, the name of the book, Richard Eager, was his nickname given to him by fellow soldiers. Because he was so eager. They called him Richard Eager. He was so eager to do it right. And basically, it was because he was an Eagle Scout to the bone. He learned his lessons of being a good, fine Eagle Scout. And he seemed to be like an Eagle Scout for the rest of his life. But he did do a great job. In fact, he was such a fine pilot that as soon as he graduated from the Randolph flying school down in Randolph, instead of going off, they kept him to teach other pilots. They wouldn't let him go to war. So for 2 years, he flew and taught pilots and navigators, and then became even a better pilot with the B-17. So as far as the dog, Judge was an amazing, a hound, you might say, and a dear, dear, dear friend of Richard or Dick. I mean, it was his best friend. And so there are lovely stories of the dog, including, sadly, when the dog died. But again, lessons in life as you grow up with your with your pets, even. You have lessons in life.
You probably mentioned this before, but what was Richard's job on the B-17? There are a bunch of different ones.
Yeah, there are 10 men on a B-17, and Dad was the pilot. He was the command pilot. So as you know, there's the bombardier, the co-pilot, the engineer, the radio operator, gunner, navigators, and they all worked together very cohesively. And when it came to the defense of the plane, they all had a gun, except for the pilot, basically, to protect the plane from fighters. There was always there were 9 guns that, that's the other reason, as I've already mentioned, that it was called the Flying Fortress, because it could defend itself. It didn't have to have a couple of fighters with it. That was the whole idea. So, yes, he was the pilot.
The Marine's hymn, which includes a line about Tripoli, is so poignant. I wanted to know if Richard actually mentioned these other branches aside from the Army Air Corps.
Not really. The Army Air Corps never had anything to do with the Navy or the Marines because those are on the ocean. something's going on. Anyway, I've lost my track of thought. Sorry. But they never they would see each other in passing, you might say, but no, they didn't work with each other very much at all.
What about vacations? Is that a part of what you guys did during the time?
Yeah. Yes, we got to travel a lot through the United States. We enjoyed very much, if we were in, Florida, we would travel all over Florida and see the different parks and such. And same thing with Nebraska or Texas. Or we would be seeing parts of the United States as we, make road trips, especially when we were moving from one spot to the other. So we really enjoyed the United States as much as, we could. Dad was not in the part of the Air Force that would send you to Germany for 3 years or Hawaii for 3 years. So we enjoyed vacations a lot.
Also, the Boy Scouts, where does that fit in as far as Richard and also you maybe wanting to, be a part of the community?
Okay. He was a Boy Scout, and the scouts would meet at the basement of the church, and they also were very involved in the church. His mother was in the choir, had a beautiful voice. So scouting was really important for this family and for many other families in Knoxville. I think, again, Dad was a little fearful about going on and getting his Eagle Scout because he had to get a swimming badge. That meant a swimming badge not only to know how to swim really well, but to be able to rescue somebody. Dad was a little fearful. And so there's a whole story about how he overcame that fear, again, with the help of a mentoring adult. And so that is why it meant so much to him that he accomplished becoming an Eagle Scout. And as I said, he was somewhat of an Eagle Scout his entire life. So I think I actually became a Girl Scout and a Brownie and a Girl Scout because probably my father was a Scout. That's influenced me. And my brother was a Boy Scout. It was a lot of fun. The principles of the Boy Scout principles are really good principles for running your life, living your life, I should say.
You mentioned some of the wars outside of World War II, Korea. When did his career really start to dwindle down?
It never dwindled down. The being in World War II was huge. And then going back into the Air Force and flying these jets were huge. The B-58, he was the commander of the test squadron. And again, testing these planes all the time, making sure they can go the speed they're supposed to go, deliver bombs if they have to. He was at his height, the B-58 test squadron commander, and then he retired. Then he became very involved at the B-70. He became very involved with the B-70, which was an amazing airplane, jet, of course, could go even further than Mach 2. And only two were built, but he was involved in explaining this airplane to Congress or anybody else that needed to have information on this B-70. Unfortunately, or not unfortunately, the B-70 was being developed as also the intercontinental rocket systems. So it became apparent that the United States could defend itself with rockets and not manned bombers. So they did not decide to build, any other B-70s. So, and one actually crashed because it was run into by a fighter. They were having a photograph time in the air, and there was a horrible accident. So he retired, and I guess that would be a dwindle, and then he stayed very active, traveling and then writing his book.
Where can we read more about Richard Evans? Are you the only person writing on this?
What do you mean writing? You can buy the book online for Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, and many, many other bookstores show the book online. There's a hardcover and a soft cover. And on Kindle, KDP, Kindle, Amazon, you can get the digital. And I think a lot of people really prefer the digital, especially because they're traveling and they can just bring out their iPad or whatever and start reading, reading. So it's becoming very popular. I'm really glad that I put the book on digital. It's very, very handsome on digital. The photographs came through beautifully. Not as many bookstores carry it. I think oftentimes for a book like this, they say it's in line, it's online and you can get it literally in 24 hours, but they don't necessarily put it in their inventory. You ask another question. What was it on that?
I think it was if anyone else was doing this kind of research.
Oh, thank you. The book's finished, and I don't think anybody else is doing this kind of research anymore. The book, as I said, the research has been done. Of course, there's always checks and balances. There's always making sure that one little mistake, oh my gosh, let's fix that. But so far, so good. So my research is now on finding people like you to talk with and to spread the word of these interesting stories that I think a lot of people will enjoy. The book is getting excellent reviews, which is makes me very happy.
In addition to your reviews, well, can you actually speak to some of those reviews?
Well, they talk about, thank you. That's interesting. In the reviews, they talk about understanding more about World War II because it's a more detailed, here's one person's description who was there. The interviews talk about not understanding what was going on in North Africa. You hear about World War II over the Pacific. You hear about World War II with the British defending themselves from the Germans who are sitting there in France and in Germany and everywhere else. You read about that, but not as much information on North Africa. I think people have reviewed it and appreciated the information on the B-17 and what an amazing plane, because my father would describe you know, how he flew it and what he did and how he got out of trouble with an accident about to happen, for example. The people really appreciated that information. They appreciated the fact that there was more information on what kind of personality General Montgomery was, you know, just an absolute amazing general. And what was he like when he wasn't on camera, for example? So those are some of the positive, I mean, it's, they're all positive. It's a five-star reviews. Another really nice thing is that the book has received two awards or two finalist medals in the military history and autobiography. And these were awarded in May by the Next Generation Indie Book Awards program. So I'm really, really pleased about that. It's a finalist and two awards. So that was really great.
Are you doing any events, particularly in person where you live, because you mentioned your publisher, any outreach?
Yes. I've been asked to speak a couple of places lately and will be asked again. I'm pretty sure. I've got some wonderful photographs to show the audience, and it's really really fun to do that. And then each photograph, of course, has a wonderful story. These are photographs, you know, out of the book. You know, 150 photographs in this book kind of helps it. Why, you know, it's why it's so big. But the other thing is, my husband and I flew in a B-17. Several years ago. And I wanted to hear the sound of the engines, the brakes, the smell, just as much as I could to feel what my father must have felt, except he was in war. So it was a wonderful, I took video of being in this B-17, and I've been able to patch that together and show the folks that I've been talking to. So yes, I enjoy that, to speak to different groups, but I don't plan on traveling to other cities. For one thing, travel's pretty expensive now. But the podcasts are very, very helpful if folks happen upon and want to learn a little World War II, North Africa, B-17 history. So really appreciate the podcast opportunity.
Do you have any final thoughts for your audience, your listeners, people, anyone, scholars?
Oh, scholars, please read, because there's a lot of history in this book, and a lot of history that's corrected. And let me give you an example. My father flew the B-17 into Palermo Field. General Montgomery and all of his staff were in that airplane, and they flew in to meet General Patton. General Patton told Monty that the field was fine for a feet B-17. So Dad flew over the airfield. They weren't airports in those days, and realized it was too short. And while he was circling, another smaller plane, a DC-3, flew in, overran the runway, and ended up in some trees and caught fire. That showed you that it was a dangerous field. My father really felt like he should just fly Monty back and not have that meeting, but he knew how important that meeting was. The wind was, there was a good headwind, he could tell, because he could see the smoke from the plane that had run into the off the field. So he realized he could do it. So he started to land and realized when they landed that brakes were gone, completely gone. So there was that was probably sabotage. So my father had training in emergency landings. And so he performed a ground loop, which is extremely dangerous, but it will save your life. Ground loop is when you're going down the runway and you turn completely 180 degrees and go the other direction because your runway is running out. So my point of this story is that, and that's why this is a piece of history, is other books that I, oh, by the way, the ground loop was successful. Everybody got really you know, it was centrifugal forces in a ground loop. So everybody got, you know, got thrashed, you know, in the plane, but they made it. Again, the story is that several books that I read said that this is when the B-17 Teresa Lita crashed, and it was and burned, and it did not. My father did a ground loop. Everybody got out and had their meeting, and they got back in again, and he flew them off of Palermo, out of Palermo, and they landed in a large another airbase with a huge length of runway that he could control the stop by using just the engines. And so that was incorrect history. And it threw me for a loop when I first read it, because you can't imagine. I mean, no, that didn't happen. And I guess what did happen is maybe a reporter saw the flames of the DC-3, which were put out very quickly, and then combined that with the B-17. And then all of a sudden it's written in a book. So that's why for academics, there's a lot of history in this book. Other people will just enjoy this book because of the stories of family, of the war, and the different people that were with my father and their descriptions as well. The other thing I wanted to mention that, and you did too, and I really appreciate this very, very much, is that all proceeds are going to the Air Force Aid Society. I've absorbed all the book costs, and this is because my father felt the ground crew people were so important to my father being able to survive the war. These are the folks who fixed the airplane so it could take off the next day and you could be secure that it would be able to land, come back home. And these were the folks who packed the peanut butter jelly sandwiches for the crew, the flight crew. These are the people that made sure the runways were clear, fixed the engines over the night, as I said, packed your parachute. So the Air Force Aid Society supports all of those folks now. And so it's a scholarship, educational scholarship in my father's name, which is Colonel Richard Ernest Evans. And it's already in process of being endowed, which is very exciting.
Great to hear. This has been a podcast episode of the New Books Network with your host, Nathan Moore. We thank Barbara Kinnear for enlightening us about Richard Eager, A Pilot's Story. Keep up to date on all things NBN, history, and literature to get more episodes in the future.